All right.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, all you magnificent melonheads of the world. Happy Tuesday, everybody. Today is July 7th, 2026. And our top story this morning is Samsung's earnings. And to say they were good would be to put it mildly. Samsung's earnings weren't good. Samsung's earnings weren't even great. They were, what's greater than great? They were awesome, incredible, stupendous, whatever you want to say. A 19x increase in quarterly profit. All right, what's that? A 1,900% increase year over year in quarterly profit? That's a pretty good quarter, you might say to yourself. And you would be correct. Revenue more than doubled, 171 trillion won. Apparently won are like next to worthless. But yeah, still, that's a lot of won. They made a lot of won. And the stock, it was down 7%, as a matter of fact. Matter of fact, it dragged the whole Kospi index down 5%. The Kospi show has been just amazing these last couple of weeks. 5 to 10% moves on a daily basis. What the hell is going on with Samsung? What the hell is going on in South Korea? Well, look, you guys know this story, the AI bubble and the memory shortage. The build out of data centers has bought up all of the high bandwidth memory, all the RAM, all the DRAM, everything. It's all been bought up. The prices are skyrocketing. Sam Altman and Dario Modi and Jensen Huang bought all the memory. And so iPhones are getting more expensive. Everything's getting more expensive because of it. And Samsung's earnings are exploding because of that. Their profit margins are getting fat because they are one of the few companies, along with people like Micron and SK Hynix, who make this stuff. But that being said, the stock has already rallied 150% year to date. Some of these stocks have tripled or quadrupled over the last 12 months. And so, yeah, a lot of it was baked in. And at the same time, a lot of it is baked in. A lot of people are wondering, hey, is this really sustainable? These results, maybe they're a little too good. They're so good, they're scaring us. It's kind of like, you know, when kid says, Mom, I made some money. Oh, great. And then he opens up his backpack and it's full of $100 bills. You just know that kid got into something he shouldn't have and that it's too good to be true. By the way, how do I get that problem? Anyways, yeah. So if that's what a beat looks like and the stock drops 7%, dragging the whole index down 5%, what would a miss look like? I don't know. Maybe we'll see someday. Now, also going on this morning, the other market that has gone wacky, the energy markets and oil markets. We had two tankers were hit yesterday in the Strait of Hormuz again. We had a Qatari LNG tanker and a Saudi oil tanker were both hit by Iranian drones or missiles. There's conflicting reports of what. No reported casualties. The price of oil is up about 50 cents. Yeah, that's all. Tankers burning, ships being hit. And the world's one of the world's most vital waterways is good for a bump of 50 cents in the price of oil. Now, both of these ships were hit on the U.S. controlled or U.S. recommended southern route that hugs the coast of Oman. So it's basically, you know, tell the Iranians you're coming and use their approved route or they'll blow you up. And remember, the Iranians only said toll free for 60 days. So is everybody going to be paying tolls in another month? Or is the world, the U.S., the world, whoever, finally going to do something about it? I don't know. It's a little early in the week to be having this problem, though. Everybody knows we have our wars on weekends now and a peace deal by Sunday night before futures start trading. So I don't know. Are we going to just like have ships get shot at for the next 3 days? And then after the market closes on Friday, we'll retaliate and then we'll all come back to the peace table just in time for Sunday dinner. Apparently that's the way of things. But oil not reacting at all to more conflict in the Middle East. And I've been wondering this out loud for the last couple of shows. What the hell's going on? Is the world whistling past the graveyard? Are we really just burning down our reserves and the oil market is ignoring it? And one day the tanks are going to run dry. You're going to hear this big slurping sound and everything's going to grind to a halt and panic will ensue. Or has there been some kind of massive demand destruction somewhere, China? And we're just not hearing about it. How could oil only be up 50 cents on this news? How could we be talking about a supply glut in the oil market if the world's most vital oil waterway is choked off? One of these two things is incorrect. I don't know which one. That's why I'm staying the hell out of the oil market right now. I there is some big variable here we can't see. I don't know what it is. Not playing. Good luck if you are. Also going on this morning, SpaceX joins the NASDAQ 100 today. It has been 15 trading days since the IPO. Again, they changed the rules to allow NASDAQ in after just 15 days instead of 3 months, because we changed the rules if the company is big enough. For some reason, those investor protections are no longer required. So ETFs and passive vehicles, mutual funds that track the index will be buying the stock. It's currently trading about $160 after IPOing at $135. Trump accounts are here. Oh, I hate this topic. Look, the government borrowing, printing money to buy stocks is stupid. I hate this idea. That being said, this government stock pump is giving away free money. And so if you qualify, you'd be dumb not to take it. So we'll talk about who is eligible and for what. We've got Russian bond yields are spiking dramatically. Fuel shortages spreading almost everywhere in the country now. This is the largest refinery in Russia was hit yesterday by the Ukrainians. Their big refinery in Omsk was hit by Ukrainian drones. I've been saying this for a couple of days too. Something is about to give in this Russia-Ukraine conflict. I don't know what it's going to look like, a peace deal or a massive escalation, but the Russians are on an unsustainable footing right now. These Ukrainian drone strikes targeting fuel in Crimea in particular, but also fuel production elsewhere in the country. The Russians just can't stay here. They have to do something. What do they do? Do they lean in or pull back? I guess we'll just have to wait and see, but we'll show you what's going on in their bond market and their financial system. And also, we're going to talk about Codelco. That's the Chilean state copper miner. We got to talk about this one because, well, after being nationalized years ago by a communist dictator, they're struggling to mine copper. Bunch of people died when a mine collapsed, and it turned out that executives at the company had hid that the mine was unsustainable. Oh, wait, I thought that's only the kind of stuff that greedy capitalists do. No, greedy communists do it too, because greed is not a function of capitalism. Greed is a function of human nature. And just because you're communism and when the cameras are running, we say we all share, doesn't mean those people aren't greedy anymore. No, they're just as greedy as their capitalist cousins. Capitalism just gives the average person a choice about whether they want to deal with them or not. And so it's important to talk about what's going on at Codelco, because here we are talking about nationalizing our freaking AI companies, you know, government taking stakes in the AI companies. Stock, again, it's just a government-funded money-printing stock pump. But still, it doesn't go well. Nationalization never goes well. Why would we want to repeat that here? I don't know, but that's what we're talking about doing. We've also got DeepSeek is supposedly developing their own chip this morning, according to Reuters. This will be a chip made for inference that DeepSeek hopes will reduce their reliance on NVIDIA chips, those same NVIDIA chips that they were never supposed to have in the first place. How are they reducing their reliance on NVIDIA chips? How did they get them to become reliant at all to begin? Maybe that's beside the point here. DeepSeek developing their own chip. Again, everybody is going after NVIDIA's market share. And of course, it just wouldn't be the morning show if we didn't wrap up with a trip through private credit. We've had a lot of news coming out on private credit recently, and Kobayashi Leonard did a pretty good job of aggregating and summarizing that. So we'll talk about that at the end of the show. But first, we got to shrink my big melon of a head, and let's see what's going on in the world of finance. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button so you can come back and have your coffee with the melon heads, because we do this every business day. Right now, the S&P 500 is barely moving, lower by 7 points, 0.1% in the red. The Dow is in the green, higher by 247 points, about 0.5% to the upside for the Dow. And the NASDAQ is down nearly 1%, 290 points in the red. Looks like that sell-off in Korea may be spreading a little bit to U.S. tech this morning. And let's talk about that Korea sell-off, because here is the KOSPI show. This is the KOSPI South Korean Index. It's basically SK Hynix and Samsung. That's pretty much what the index is. Those two companies make up more than half of the index. And once again, big red day yesterday. Circuit breakers were tripped. At one point, the index was down more than 8%. They tripped off the circuit breakers, shut everything down. It's like the 10th time this month they've shut the market down because of volatility. Ended up recovering a little bit when they brought it back, closed down just under 5% lower for the KOSPI. Looking over at the U.S. dollar, it's a little bit stronger here, 100.93, higher by 6 basis points. Not a lot going on in the Dixie this morning. The bond market is also quiet as well. The 30-year yield is at 5.008, higher by a point and a half, but back above 5%. The 10-year yield is at 4.496, higher by a point, almost 2 points, 2 basis points. The 2-year yield is at 4.137, higher by a point and change. And the 1 month is at 3.650, lower by a point and change. Not a lot happening in bonds. Bitcoin ended up recovering yesterday and finished the day in the green. It's red again this morning, $63,200 for Bitcoin. That's lower by about $800 after the dip buyers showed up shortly after the opening bell yesterday. And I don't know why I said opening bell in terms of Bitcoin, because opening and closing bell is irrelevant. Bitcoin trades 24/7, but it was about 9:45 a.m. Eastern time that the dip buyers showed up yesterday and Bitcoin rallied. Again, it really looks like this chart is about to roll over and we are heading to a new low for the cycle. And I wanted to talk about this post from Junk Bond Investor on X. At Junk Bond Invest. And this is a pretty good speculation here about what Saylor is up to with his stretch preferred equity, the dividend that is forcing Saylor to sell Bitcoin. It says, this is how the strategy distressed trade works. Buy distressed preferreds cheap. And by distressed preferreds, he means stretch shares below $100. Buy those cheap. Preferreds cap your upside because you have to pay so much in dividends. So pitch swapping into discounted new preferreds or straight common. When you say discounted new preferreds, like maybe Super Stretch or Stretch Junior, Stretch 2. Oh yeah, you lost a whole bunch of money on Stretch, but try your new Coke. It's going to be even better. Or instead of that, buy back Stretch or swap it out for common stock and MicroStrategy. Dilute the hell out of your Strategy shareholders in order to avoid having to pay any future dividends to your Stretch shareholders, who you already basically robbed, in order to buy Bitcoin. Everybody loses money except Michael Saylor. Why does Strategy want it? Preferreds pay monthly. Common pays nothing. So if they buy back those Stretch shares and replace them with MicroStrategy stock, they won't have to pay that dividend anymore. Retire paper below face value, capture the discount, kill the monthly dividend, and pay with dilution. No SEC registration required. And that may be what Saylor's strategy has been all along here. Basically, if you bought Stretch, your losses have financed Michael Saylor's control of the Bitcoin supply. Congratulations. Guys, we always say it. If anybody is ever out there promising you a risk-free 10, 15% return or 10 or 15% yield, run, do not walk for the exits. There is no such thing as a risk-free 10% yield. Shout out to Junk Bond Investor for that one. Looking over at commodities this morning, spot gold is higher by a little more than $4, $4,169, up by 0.1%. Spot silver is at $61.33. That's actually lower by 72 cents. Silver had a pretty good day yesterday, though. 1.15% in the red this morning, but I still like the shiny. Copper is pretty much unchanged, up 0.1%. Platinum is up 1.1%. Palladium is up by a little more than 1%. And we have got crude oil higher, by 72 cents now for crude oil, 1% higher, $69.29 for August WTI. We'll get to oil in just a second, though. First, let's talk about Samsung. Samsung's record profit fails to impress after AI chip rally. And again, record profit doesn't quite tell the whole story. This was really incredible. Samsung's quarterly profit surged 19-fold, prompting investors to cash out of a near 150% rally this year that had baked in the AI-fueled growth. And that's pretty much, that's it in a nutshell, guys. The market had already priced it in. Everybody was expecting results that were that good. I don't know how you can expect a 19-fold increase in profit, but that's what the market was expecting. The company share slid more than 10% in Seoul, leading a plunge in the benchmark KOSPI that triggered a brief circuit breaker suspension. Investors had propelled the stock higher through much of the year, betting on hefty profit margins from a historic build-out of the AI infrastructure. Korea's largest company on Tuesday posted preliminary operating income of 89.4 trillion won, $58 billion, for the June quarter, beating projections by about 6%. But not enough to impress investors accustomed to eye-popping growth numbers. So it was even a beat. They even beat those lofty expectations, but it just wasn't enough. Now, another thing I want to point out here is that they're talking about how the share slid more than 10%, leading to a plunge in the KOSPI that triggered a brief circuit breaker suspension. Those breakers are getting tripped on a daily basis now. And much like any of you guys who work in electric, we'll probably let you know, if you're blowing a breaker every day, that doesn't mean just go down in the basement and flick it, cycle it, turn it back on. That means you've got something majorly wrong somewhere. Something is shorted. Something is breaking. Something is overheating, burning up, and it's going to cause a freaking fire if you don't fix the problem. Don't just reset the breaker and rinse, repeat. But that's what they keep doing in Korea. Something is majorly wrong. All this volatility, and again, volatility typically marks the top. Earnings by the world's largest memory maker are in the spotlight as investors seek to justify sky-high investments and valuations around AI. Global semiconductor shares jumped to record levels this year but have hit turbulence on fears of increased competition, possible overcapacity, and whether plans for hundreds of billions of dollars in investment will pay off. They won't. Shares of Japan's Kioxia Holdings, which competes with Samsung and NAND flash memory, fell 11% in Tokyo, while chip gear supplier Tokyo Electron and Screen Holdings also lost ground. The sell-off spread to Europe, where Samsung supplier ASML slid more than 4%. The figures, while extraordinary on an absolute basis, aren't that much better than what the street was modeling for a stock market sitting at the epicenter of the hottest sector in the whole market, said Adam Crisafulli, founder of Vital Knowledge. Revenue more than doubled to 171 trillion won. Samsung reported record quarterly profit despite provisions to pay big bonuses for chip employees, as much as $400,000 this year, a windfall that's escalating a national debate about what constitutes fair compensation. Guys, amazing quarter for Samsung. It's probably going to stay this way for a while, but the market sold off anyway. And this is the chart of Samsung stock. And you may be looking at this and saying, Jack, that looks just like that chart of the Kospi index. And you would be exactly right because, again, Samsung and SK Hynix pretty much are the Kospi index. Down almost 7% yesterday, but still up 146% year to date and up 266% over the last 5 years, almost all of which happened in the last 12 months or so. All right. Meanwhile, in oil markets, two tankers damaged near Strait of Hormuz after reports of Iranian missile fire, sources say. A Qatari LNG tanker and a Saudi-flagged crude oil tanker were damaged near the Strait of Hormuz, sources said on Tuesday, after reports that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard fired missiles at ships in the waterway overnight. The Al Rakayat was loaded with liquefied natural gas and sent out distress signals seeking assistance after it was hit on its port side. By the way, a fire on an LNG tanker is a very serious thing. Liquefied natural gas is, you know, super cooled to whatever degrees below zero to liquefy it. And then if a fire breaks out on a ship, that gas starts to boil off. And, well, now all of a sudden you're producing huge amounts of flammable gas inside a compressed storage container. Yeah, oh yeah, that's just going to be great for everyone involved. The crew were safe and were being evacuated, other sources said, but the engine room was on fire and filled with smoke, making the full extent of the damage unclear. Mayday, okay, they're talking about the Mayday here. It's the first time an LNG ship from Qatar, a mediator in talks between Washington and Tehran, has been struck since the start of the Iran war at the end of February. Iranian missile attacks caused extensive damage to Qatar's LNG facilities during the conflict. A Saudi flag tanker believed to be the supertanker Wedjan was also damaged off Oman's coast, maritime security sources said. The cause was not immediately known. Gee, you think it might have been the Iranians? So two boats blown up, both using the Omani waterway that the U.S. is supposedly protecting. And oil is up. Okay, now oil's higher by $1, $69.66. Look at this oil market. I mean, guys, we're only a couple of bucks higher. We're like $4 higher than we were at the start of this conflict. You've got some flow back through the strait, but that which is flowing through the strait is either being blown up or being monitored by the IRGC, and they're going to start charging their extortion fee pretty soon. Again, what does the oil market see that none of us can see? Why, oh, why is oil still so low here? Unless there is secretly some massive demand destruction happening somewhere that we can't see. I don't know how millions of barrels of oil not getting burned wouldn't show up in other markets elsewhere. But unless China, it's the only thing I can think of is that something has happened to oil demand in China. Otherwise, the whole world is just burning down their reserves and it's just a matter of time before the tanks run dry. Maybe that's the case. Meanwhile, SpaceX joins NASDAQ 100 as Wall Street makes bullish calls, and all the analysts are lined up for their groupthink. Everybody's having a contest to see who can come up with the biggest price target for SpaceX this morning as SpaceX joins the NASDAQ 100 index Tuesday as Wall Street brokerages launch coverage of Elon Musk's rocket, satellite, and AI company with a clear consensus buy the stock. And let's stop calling SpaceX a rocket and satellite company. It's not. SpaceX is an AI company. Almost all of the company's valuation is derived from AI, a business which it does not do well at. They've abandoned much of their plans for Grok, and now they're a NeoCloud, a business with notoriously tight margins that should not be trading at the kind of valuation SpaceX is. But I digress. At least six brokers, including Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, have started coverage with buy equivalent ratings following the end of the traditional quiet period for analysts from banks that help underwrite the $86 billion IPO. Analysts are leaning into the long-term growth prospects for SpaceX, even as questions over its profitability, execution, and valuation continue to linger after a blockbuster market debut. Morgan Stanley, among the biggest bulls, said the company stands to gain from demand for AI services driven by fast-growing new industry entrants. And maybe that's why they're renting out all their data centers to Google or to Anthropic, because of all those new entrants. While NeoCloud deals are the bulk of the business near term, we see end-to-end AI services as the longer-term business model, Morgan Stanley analysts, including Adam Jonas, wrote in a note. I tell you, if SpaceX really is a NeoCloud, its valuation belongs a hell of a lot lower than it currently is. SpaceX, to give the company its official name, won swift entry into NASDAQ's main index after rule changes by the exchange operator. These adjustments allow newly listed large cap companies to be included in the NASDAQ 100 in as little as 15 trading days, down from the previous 3-month minimum. I guess when a company is big enough, you no longer need to protect retail investors anymore. The stock also became a member of the Russell 1000 index late last month, just 2 weeks after its IPO. Bloomberg Intelligence analyst Rob DeBoff estimated that SpaceX inclusion in the NASDAQ 100 and the FTSE Russell gauges would drive at least $5.4 billion in buying from index tracking funds. Demand from passive investors might have been even greater, but S&P Dow Jones Indices, a unit of S&P Global that oversees benchmarks, including the S&P 500, decided in early June to keep its existing eligibility requirements. That closed the door to fast entry for SpaceX. And by the way, my hat's off to S&P Dow Jones Indices, who held the line and did not change the rules in order to accommodate SpaceX and actually kept investor protections in place. But for now, SpaceX is trading at $159, above the $135 IPO price, slightly above the opening price on its first day of $150, currently down about $1.50 or 0.85% ahead of the opening bell today. All right, Trump accounts are here. Trump accounts for kids are now live. Here's everything parents need to know. Yes, your government-mandated, Fed-supported money-printing stock pump has finally arrived. But again, it's free money. If they're offering it to you, you'd be stupid not to take it. President Donald Trump on Monday rang the opening bell of the New York Stock Exchange to mark the first trading day of the newly launched Trump Accounts for Children. With the ringing of the opening bell for the stock market, those accounts will now begin to grow right along with our booming economy. And I really believe we're going to have the biggest boom of all, Trump said, as he rang the bell remotely from the Oval Office. Okay, blah, blah, blah. What is a Trump account? According to the government legislation, Trump accounts are a new form of traditional investment retirement account, or IRA, that have been created for the benefit of children with special rules applying. Once opened, an eligible account will automatically receive a one-time tax-free $1,000 contribution from the federal government. There's an asterisk attached to that. Keep that in mind. The funds plus any further contributions will be automatically invested in an index fund that tracks the S&P 500, which itself tracks the performance of the top 500 companies trading on the stock market. Contributions to Trump accounts will be invested in the State Street Spider Portfolio S&P 500 ETF, according to the Treasury. State Street's going to make themselves a nice chunk of management fees off of that. This will remain as the default index for funds to be invested in over the coming months, but the Treasury said it expects to make other investment options available for parents and guardians in the near future. All right. Does your baby qualify for a $1,000 Trump account, and what do you need to do? Babies that are U.S. citizens born between January 1st, 2025 and December 31st, 2028 are eligible to receive the one-time government seed contribution of $1,000 in their account. This time frame falls within Trump's second term in office. In order to set up a Trump account for eligible children, parents or guardians must submit an IRS Form 4547. This can be done via the Trump Accounts app when filing taxes, or through the IRS website, individual online accounts. And you may notice IRS Form 4547. Yeah, that's Trump was the 45th and the 47th president. You see what he did there? He just can't help but put his name or his fingerprint on everything. A maximum of $5,000 overall can be contributed to each account annually from parents, other family and friends, and the employers of parents and guardians. Most contributions will be taxed, but employers can provide up to $2,500 a year tax-free per employee, not per child. State and local governments can also make tax-free contributions. All right, so here's the thing. If you want the free money, if you want the $1,000, your kid has to have been born between January 1st of 2025 and December 31st, 2028. If you have a kid that is under the age of 18 but does not fall in that birth range, you can still start a Trump account for that kid, but you're not going to get the free $1,000. And look, guys, we're all going to pay for this in the form of higher inflation or higher taxes one way or another. The government is not just giving money to people, right? When the government gives helicopter money, we pay for it in the form of higher inflation. So if you're eligible for the $1,000, you might as well take it because it's going to cost you on the back end through higher cost of living. So I think this is a stupid idea. I think this is just a silly collectivist stock market pump. Government printing money to buy stocks. Gee, why didn't Venezuela think of that? It's not going to end well, but again, that's what you need to do. Fill out that form 4547. All right, let's talk about this one. Russia's oil refineries are burning, and now so is its bond market. I've been saying this for a while now, guys. Something is about to give in this conflict. I don't know what, but the current trajectory is not sustainable. Fuel shortages in Russia may achieve what nothing and nobody else could, force Putin to the negotiating table, or it could force Putin to escalate. We don't know what. Russian oil refineries are burning as Vladimir Putin's war on Ukraine is now being deeply felt domestically. An analysis in the Financial Times suggests that so far this year, long-range Ukrainian drones have struck Russian targets, primarily in European Russia, 194 times, and that number is accelerating. On Monday, the Ukrainians successfully attacked Russia's largest refinery, responsible for 8% of national capacity, in Omsk, some 2,500 kilometers from the border. That is a huge range, 2,500 kilometers from the border. All right, the Ukrainians are reaching deep inside Russia with impunity, hitting these targets. The ramifications of the fuel crisis are already showing up in asset prices. The disruptive impact on the $1 trillion Russian bond market of what Ukraine's president has called a 40-day influence operation has been severe. Yields on Russian 10-year government bonds have jumped almost 200 basis points since the start of June to 16.62%. This reflects not just the inflationary impact of surging energy prices, but also heavy debt issuance to fund the war in Ukraine launched by Putin in February of 2022. And here you can see the interest rate on the Russian 10-year bond spiking 2% since the beginning of June. It's gone vertical, and it's still going vertical at 16.62% interest for a 10-year Russian bond. Contrast that with U.S. government, which is able to borrow at 4.5%. Yeah, Russia's got to pay up to borrow to finance this war. Russian financial assets are, for the vast majority of international investors, prohibited from a legal standpoint and impossible from an operational standpoint. That's mainly due to U.S. and European sanctions. The main players in Russian fixed income markets then are domestic institutions that are limited to where they can invest, and perhaps some institutions in friendly nations, such as Belarus and Kazakhstan. On Monday, Reuters reported that European intelligence agencies had prepared a note on the probability of a banking crisis in Russia in 2026. Among other factors, the report highlighted that 500,000 Russians went bankrupt last year, that as many as 15% of bank loans were non-performing, and that the number is likely to increase. The risk to Russia's financial system, according to the document, is explosive. The economic disruption and the social mayhem this Ukraine campaign with Russia's borders has inflicted threatens the Kremlin's capacity to sustain its war effort as it stretches well into its fifth year. This may prove to be the coercive factor that finally gives Putin no alternative but to come to the negotiating table to end the war. The implications of a peace deal for global markets should not be underestimated. It would likely mean lower energy prices, especially in Europe, a huge rebuilding program in Ukraine, and a lower cost of energy applied to European stocks. That's according to a report in May from Morgan Stanley's European equity team led by Maria Zavaluk. The U.S.-funded news organization Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty estimates that a quarter of Russia's fuel production capacity has been lost in the last 12 months, and that two-thirds of the regions of its regions now have placed restrictions on the sale of fuel. Large lines of vehicles at gas stations, many of which have depleted supplies, have been forming for over a week now, and many Russians have been forced to flee the contested peninsula of Crimea completely owing to fuel and energy shortages there. All right, so let's assume at least some of this is a little bit hyperbolic. At least some of this may be Western propaganda driven, but the video circulating of refineries getting hit day in and day out, that's not propaganda. That's actual footage. That's real. So how bad is it? 16.6% borrowing costs. There's no way the Russians can keep up with that for very long. And if these fuel shortages are half as bad as they're describing, you're going to have social unrest in Russia in the not too distant future. Something has got to change here. The Russians cannot stay on their current footing. Meanwhile, Chile reviews Codelco's future amid global copper demand boom. Maybe there's a lesson in here about nationalizing the AI companies. You guys tell me. As global demand for copper skyrockets, one of the world's largest mining companies finds itself in a precarious situation. Chile's state-owned company, Codelco, long the mainstay of the country's mining industry and a crucial source of government revenue, is facing a $25 billion debt and its lowest production in 28 years. It's also embroiled in a series of controversies, including a fatal accident and investigations into inflated production figures. What, this just in? Communists suck at running things? More news at 11. These difficulties have raised concerns that Codelco's model is failing to capitalize on the benefits of near-record copper prices in a context where artificial intelligence and the energy transition are driving demand for this metal. They've also sparked a debate that would have been almost unthinkable just a few years ago. Should Codelco abandon its growth ambitions and grant a more significant role to private capital? It is an issue that has taken on new urgency since hardline conservative José Antonio Kast assumed the presidency of Chile earlier this year, marking the most pronounced shift to the right since the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet half a century ago. Even within the new Chilean government, few politicians advocate for the denationalization of Codelco, making a radical change seems unlikely. Created in the 1970s when Chile wrested control of its vast mines from U.S. companies, Codelco became a symbol of economic sovereignty. Today, it occupies almost a sacred place in the country's political history, having survived the wave of privatizations of industry during the Pinochet regime. However, the copper market heading toward its largest deficit ever, authorities and industry representatives are exploring ways to reform the mining company, reduce its debt, and improve its profitability. Options range from asset sales and investment cuts to expanding joint ventures and sharing infrastructure. If Chile fails to act, Codelco risks missing out on a historic surge in copper demand that has driven the metals prices to record highs. In late July of 2025, a collapse at the El Teniente, Codelco's most profitable mine, claimed the lives of six workers. It was Chile's deadliest mining accident in decades and paralyzed work in a key expansion area. An internal audit uncovered inconsistencies and concealment of information in technical reports related to a rock burst at the same mine 2 years earlier, leading to the dismissal of three executives. Prosecutors and regulators are investigating whether these deficiencies in the 2023 reporting affected risk monitoring before last year's deadly collapse. Codelco is also facing multiple investigations into inflated production figures that allowed it to meet its targets. An internal review revealed that the miner had overstated its 2025 copper production by nearly 27,000 metric tons, equivalent to about 2% of its output. The scandals have reignited a longstanding debate about whether Codelco needs deeper reform. And look at this chart shown in the image here. This is copper production from Codelco's mines going back to the year 2000. And since about 2017, it has started to fall off a cliff. Now, what, about 1,300, I think this is in million metric tons or 1,000 metric tons, down from 1,730 in 2017. So, look, nationalizing natural resources, Indonesia's doing it. They'll learn to regret it. They did it in Venezuela. They ran the whole country into the ground. They did it in Codelco, and now they're running Codelco into the ground. And here we are in the United States talking about essentially nationalizing the AI companies. Just maybe there are some historical examples we could look to that would tell us, no, that's not such a great idea. Meanwhile, China's DeepSeek is developing its own AI chip, sources say. Chinese startup DeepSeek is developing its own AI chip, according to three people familiar with the matter, a push that could reduce its reliance on NVIDIA's and Huawei's chips, which it has depended on to train and run its globally popular models. Period. Pause. Hold on. Wait. Stop. Back the truck up. A push that could reduce its reliance on NVIDIA, which it has depended on to train and run its globally popular models. How did this Chinese company get those NVIDIA GPUs? I thought it was illegal. I thought it was just an unfounded conspiracy theory that companies might actually be smuggling these GPUs into China using intermediaries like Singapore and Malaysia, right? Oh, that's right. A whole bunch of Supermicro guys just got arrested and indicted, and the company's offices are getting raided because they've been doing it this whole time, just like we all knew. But we all pretended it wasn't happening because we want our stock to go up. Well, that might be a moot point because DeepSeek is making their own chip. The chip is designed for inference, the stage of AI computing in which a trained model generates responses for users rather than for training new models, the sources said. If successful, DeepSeek's expansion into the semiconductor development would mark a major strategic shift for a company widely hailed in China as the country's AI champion, potentially adding to challenges faced by Chinese tech giant Huawei. Shares of NVIDIA slipped about 2% in pre-market trading on that news. NVIDIA stock currently down about 1.5%, trading at $192.57, off by about $3. Full disclosure, I am short NVIDIA. And last but not least, Kobayashi Letter had a pretty good write-up on private credit. I think much of this is derived from a Wall Street Journal article we saw late last week about private credit, but this distills it down pretty well. Stress in the U.S. private credit market is intensifying. Investors requested a record $15.6 billion in redemptions from private credit funds in the second quarter of 2026. This marks the third consecutive quarterly increase by a total of $13 billion, or 500%. More and more people want their money back. Furthermore, just 38% of these requests were met, down from 53% in Q1, leaving $9.7 billion in unmet redemptions, the largest backlog on record. Blue Owl's flagship fund, Blue Owl Credit Income, was the most impacted at 19% of shares outstanding, with 14% unmet, the highest redemption rate among its large competitors. It's worth pointing out that that 19% number was down slightly from 21% last quarter. This was followed by Apollo at 16% requested with 11% unmet, and Ares at 14% requested with 9% unmet. Both of those numbers were bigger than they were prior quarters. Meanwhile, inflows into the private credit industry declined by 75% since January to $500 million in May, the smallest monthly intake in at least 18 months. One in four, or three out of four private credit investors is now holding back, saying they don't want to put any more money in the fund. This private credit crisis shows no signs of slowing. And then they include this visual. Again, this was from the Wall Street Journal article a few days ago, but this is pretty important. The light blue here is the actual money that was returned to investors. And then the total chart here, which includes this darker, we'll call it green number, that is the total that was requested, and the green is what people asked to get back but didn't get back. So the important thing, less money overall was returned to investors this quarter, even though far more money was requested back from those same investors in the same quarter. So the problems in private credit are getting worse, and the amount of money they're able to give back is also getting worse. This not good here, not good. Now, this story is probably going to go quiet for a couple of months again, because now these quarterly reports are behind us. So you're going to have another two and a half months of relative calm in private credit, unless we get another Tricolor or First Brands blow up. But we'll get another couple of months of quiet now, and we'll be back here probably sometime August, September, talking about the same things, big increases in withdrawal requests, smaller redemptions made. Problems in private credit not going away, folks. And I just want to say thank you, everybody, for having your coffee with the Melonheads again this morning. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button so you can come back and have your coffee with us tomorrow as well. Thank you very much to my magnanimous Melonheads on YouTube, Patreon, and Buy Me a Coffee for supporting the channel. Links down below should you feel so inclined. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Love you guys. Everybody, till next time, live small and dream big.